This is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as we begin this week's broadcast of the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the first page where we find the biz articles. There are four or five articles in here about Triangle happening. So here's under the heading of Bull Durham. The article, in 1988, film gave Triangle a lift. You can debate the best sports films for hours, but one that's in the conversation is Bull Durham. The film debuted June 15, 1988. 33 years ago, it sparked a surge of interest in minor league baseball. Bull Durham was a source of pride for the Triangle, which lacked the national presence it has now. Durham's population then was only 196,000, half of what it is now, and the film captures the city before its scruffy tobacco warehouses were revitalized. And seeing places around the area on a big screen, including the quaint Durham Athletic Park and the bar scene at Mitch's Tavern in Raleigh, was thrilling. With the film, the Triangle announced its presence with authority and hasn't lollygagged since. And under the heading of Southport Marina comes the article, Big Clash Over Storm Damage. Almost 1 year after a Category 1 hurricane blew through the North Carolina coast, boat owners are suing Southport Marina. They claim the piers and docks at the marina failed catastrophically during Hurricane Isaias in August, adding that virtually every boat moored at the marina was damaged, some severely. They claim Southport Marina is charging them for damages to piers and docks. According to the 22-page lawsuit, the marina failed, quote, to properly maintain, unquote, its facilities, and other local marinas and waterfront piers and docks suffered, quote, little or no significant damage, unquote. According to the complaint, the marina sent discrete demand packages to 185 of them, seeking to recover the cost of rebuilding the piers and docks as well as salvage expenses. And under the heading of Spirits comes the article, Big Plans for First Downtown Raleigh Distillery. The team behind Trophy Brewing Company is preparing to bring the first distillery to downtown Raleigh this summer. Chris Powers, David Lockwood, David Meeker, and Lee Stewart will open Young Hearts Distilling Company at 225 South Wilmington Street in August. Beer, wine, cocktails, and food will be served at the 111-year-old building and former Busy Bee Cafe location. The three-story establishment will include a bar area with plenty of indoor and outdoor seating and even a covered rooftop area. Chef Alex Rickey, who previously served as executive chef at Guglehoff Artisan Bakery, Restaurant, and Cafe in Durham, and master distiller Beener Killo, who is known for her absinthe recipe, have also joined Young Hearts. Under the heading Acquisition, the article, Carry Firm Makes Move into Idaho. Fathom Holdings is acquiring Epic Realty, a regional brokerage team of more than 350 agents based in Meridian, Idaho. It's Fathom's first time entering the Idaho market. Idaho is one of the country's fastest-growing real estate markets, and we're pleased to be expanding our geographic presence through Epic, a company that exemplifies our culture of servant leadership, integrity, and trust, says Fathom CEO Joshua Harley. And under the heading of U.S. Open, the article, Golfer Showcases Raleigh Company. A Raleigh-based company has a golfer flying its flag when the U.S. Open is being played June 17th through 21st at Torrey Pines Golf Course in San Diego. Andy Pope wears apparel from Bald Head Blues, which makes sportswear aimed at the golf, club, and leisure scene. Pope, 37, is playing in his fifth U.S. Open. He's got a pretty good track record. He's made three of the last four cuts, says Claude Pope, no relation, the CEO of Baldhead Blues. While Claude Pope says every bit of exposure helps, the brand is off to a strong start this year as people are looking to get out and enjoy themselves. Baldhead Blues renovated their store at Baldhead, and Pope says, we're up 45% at the retail store already. And finally, on this week's biz page, under the heading of Changing Market, is the article, Rental Trend Moves to Region. An East Raleigh home at 4129 Tocopola Street will be available to rent July 7th for $1,795 per month. And while the home looks common enough, it's actually part of a dramatic change sweeping across the rental home market. The home dates to 1996, and in 2013, a husband and wife sold the home to American Homes for Rent. That was right as the Great Recession was ending, at a time when institutional investors saw an opportunity to purchase homes at depressed prices and turn them into rentals. American Homes for Rent, based in California, launched in 2012 and now has more than 53,000 homes. At least 49 of those are in the Triangle, according to its website. Another major operator is Invitation Homes out of Dallas, with 80,000 properties in 16 markets across the United States and 22 homes in the Triangle, mostly in eastern or southern Wake County, according to county property records. And those are the numbers that are likely to rise. UNC Charlotte analyzed data for Mecklenburg County and found that major leasing companies have nearly 11,500 homes in the county, with Invitation Homes among the leaders with 2,241 properties. UNC Charlotte found Progress Residential with 2,268 houses, American Homes for Rent 2,242, Tricon with 1,627, Amherst Residential with 1,622, and First Key with 1,044 also have a major presence in the county. Most of these homes are located in starter home areas costing just over $200,000 and where supply is often tight. Next, we turn the page and we get to the Economic Development Aviation page. And under the heading of Jobs Pipeline comes the article, North Carolina Sees Surge in Interest. The possibilities are increasing for North Carolina when it comes to economic development. And that means headline-grabbing projects, such as Apple planning 3,000 jobs in Research Triangle Park, Google bringing a 1,000-job engineering hub to Durham, and Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies planning a 725-job facility in Holly Springs could be just the beginning. New numbers released by the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, the state's top recruitment engine, shows project activity is increasing. The month of May saw new project activity exceeding the same month last year by more than 47%, said Christopher Chung, CEO of EDPNC. The streak continues of all months since June 2020, with the exception of October of 2020, when new project activity has outpaced the corresponding month from the previous year, he says. Since the start of the pandemic, the Triangle has won several major expansions with job counts reaching into the hundreds and thousands. A common theme has been life science companies picking the region for new operations, but tech giants Apple and Google have generated the most buzz. At the start of June, EDPNC was working on 184 total recruitment and expansion projects. The pipeline represents a potential of 69,000 new jobs and more than $43 billion in new investment. It's consistent with the trends happening in 2021, with key sectors being food and beverage, life sciences, chemicals and plastics, and automotive. What is still down is interest from foreign companies. Chung said foreign direct investments make up 23% of the pipeline, up only slightly from the 20% that they've been tracking over the past year amid travel restrictions and other pandemic-related challenges. Now, with this article comes a nice bar graph that plots the jobs that are coming to the Triangle, and these are the biggest job wins since April of 2020. And they start with Gilead Sciences at 275, PennyMac Financial Services, 300, Invite Corporation, 3374, Grail, 398, Fidelity Investments, 500, Fuji Diosynth Biotechnology, 725, BioAgilytics, 878, Google with 1,000, Bandwidth with 1,200, and Apple with 3,000. Now under the heading of aviation on our economic development page, comes the heading of aviation and routes starting back up at RDU. Flyers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport will have to keep waiting for transatlantic flights to return. Both Delta Airlines and American Airlines have no plans to launch their flights to Paris and London until late summer at the earliest, continuing a trend of delaying the return of the flights. But in the meantime, airlines are making bets on domestic routes out of RDU. So we have a little chart showing the various airlines and their routes and the dates of launch. So American Airlines plans to launch its Destin-Fort Walton Beach, Florida flight in June, and its Nashville flight also in June. American's going to be flying to Orlando beginning June. United Airlines to San Francisco in July. American Airlines to Austin in July. American Airlines to London in August. Delta Airlines to Paris in September. Spirit Airlines to Miami in November. And finally, American Airlines to Tampa in November. And under the heading of jobs, the article, Apple wins more incentives in Maiden. As Apple plans its 3,000-job hub in Research Triangle Park, a county in western North Carolina has approved additional incentives to entice more investment. The small town of Maiden in Catawba County, located 45 miles northwest of Charlotte, has been the recipient of Apple's investment since 2009. Its massive data center there started with a single building and a $1 billion investment. That cumulative investment has now more than tripled. When Apple announced its RTP hub, it also pledged to invest another $308 million in Maiden, as well as an additional $140 million in, quote, tangible personal property, unquote. That pledge was included in the $846 million incentives package state officials approved for Apple's RTP campus. The agreement Apple has with Catawba County includes a 50% tax rebate on real property and an 85% reduction in taxes on equipment. The original equipment included 181 acres of Apple's property. Now Catawba is adding 47 additional acres. And we turn the page in this week's TBJ, and we find ourselves on the real estate page with Caleb Harshberg. Under the heading of industrial comes the article, More Space in Johnston County. A massive mixed-use development in Johnston County is gearing up to begin work on the first new building on the site after securing financing for the project earlier this month. Adventure Development recently announced its planning to begin work on a 135,000-square-foot industrial building at East Field Crossing. The company's 467-plus-acre mixed-use development outside Selma after securing financing from Dollar Bank. We look forward to breaking ground on the business park, Adventure Development President Kevin Doherty says. We're grateful for the support from the town of Selma, Johnston County, and all of the business leaders and partners who have worked with us throughout the planning and development process. The new building will be the first built at the site and makes up the start of construction on the industrial park portion of the project. Eastfield Crossing is located at I-95 exits 97 and 98 near Selma and will have a total of 3 million square feet of mixed-use space. This includes 1.5 million square foot industrial park, around 500,000 square feet of retail, multifamily, and single-family residential product, 3 hotels, and around 200,000 square feet of medical space. Daugherty says he expects it to take the next 5 to 10 years to fully build out. This new building is planned to be built on spec, but with a blazing hot demand for industrial space in the Triangle these days, it could lease up well before work is finished. Daugherty says the booming market for industrial space played a role in his decision to include an industrial park as part of the project. We're targeting advanced manufacturing and warehouse distribution type companies. There was literally no available space in Johnston County, he says. We felt that was an important piece we needed to get underway sooner rather than later. Plans for Eastfield have been in the works since 2007 when Daugherty bought his first piece of property on the site. And under the heading of sold comes the article, huge FedEx facility near RTP nets $50 million. On June the 14th, an LLC addressed to Boston-based investment management firm Eaton Vance paid $50.5 million for a 236,000-square-foot industrial facility used by FedEx Ground at 4357 South Alston Avenue. And under the heading of Glenwood South, developers team up for three-story project. A pair of developers are teaming up yet again on a project in the Triangle with plans to convert a century-old building in Raleigh's Glenwood South into a mixed-use development. Developers Luden Properties of Raleigh and North Pond Partners of Chicago recently announced plans to transform a three-story building at 122 Glenwood Avenue into creative office and retail space. Built in 1921, the building currently has three retail tenants: the Revolver Consignment Boutique, the Raleigh Wine Shop, and the Halcyon Cocktail Lounge and Event Venue. The companies acquired the property recently for $5.1 million. Plans for the project would convert the existing building into a creative office and retail property, with creative office space on the top two floors. And finally, on the real estate page, under the heading of Southeast Raleigh, Entrepreneur Hub about to rise. In the coming weeks, James Montague's F7 International Development Company, Inc., will start construction on a new retail and entrepreneurial hub called Montague Plaza in Southeast Raleigh. Plans for the project call for a $4 million building with 16,000 square feet of space for local businesses and educational programs focused on entrepreneurship. The site's located at 2718 Rock Quarry Road, next to Southeast Raleigh Magnet High School. Montague hopes to have work completed by the first quarter of next year. Multiple groups and businesses have already signed up for space in the development, including INF Cosmetic, Crown by Luxury, ISM Music Studio, Griffiths Barbershop, Outer Skin 2, Phoenix Physical Therapy, Jerk Masters Jamaican Restaurant, Dr. A. Shepherd Concierge Service, and University Luxury Rental Cars. The space will also feature a STEM program for students and young adults. And now turning the page, we reach the healthcare page of this week's TBJ, and under the heading of tobacco farming comes the article, New Deal Targeting Brazil. A Marshall tobacco company has partnered with Bayer Crop Science to help Brazilian tobacco farmers diversify their crops. Alliance One International, part of Paisas International, announced earlier this month its Brazilian subsidiary, Alliance One Brazil, has partnered with the multinational pharmaceutical and life sciences giant to provide small farm farmers with seed varieties and technology to increase their yield and income from maize. It's exciting to see how the promotion of crop diversification, such as our maize project in Brazil, can improve the overall livelihood of our farmers and likewise impact economic growth and development within their communities, says Helio Moura, Global Agronomy Director with Alliance One. Brazil was the third largest tobacco grower in the world in 2019, producing about 769,000 metric tons, just behind India, which had 804,000 metric tons, according to Statista, a consumer data provider. China was the largest producer with 2.6 million metric tons. Approximately 75% of the Brazilian Farmers Alliance won contracts Approximately 75% of the Brazilian Farmers Alliance won contracts with produce maize alongside tobacco. The farmers who already cultivate maize on average produce less than 5,500 kilograms per hectare, while Bayer's agricultural technology has the potential to increase yields to more than 10,000 kilograms per hectare, Moura says. These increased yields have the potential to improve our farmers' livelihoods through a strong basis of crop diversification, he says. The partnership started with a pilot project with 2,300 growers during the 2020 growing season, and the company received positive feedback that led to the decision to expand the program to all its farmers in Brazil. The company also intends to expand the program throughout its global operations, which Moura says includes about 300,000 farmers across 20 countries, and supports the development of markets for non-tobacco crops over the next 3 years. Alliance is also working with farmers in Tanzania to produce a compliant, sustainable sunflower crop used to produce quality crude sunflower oil, refined sunflower oil, and seed cake, Moura says. In Malawi, Moura says Alliance has distributed company-produced varieties of ground nut to farmers so they can produce value-added products for the domestic, regional, and international markets. And under the heading of oncology comes the article, RTP Cancer Firm Earns First Fast-Track Status. A local drug maker's poliovirus treatment for melanoma has received the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's fast-track designation shortly after receiving orphan drug designation. Istari Oncology said June 14th that its candidate, PVSTIPO, received the designation for advanced treatment-resistant melanoma that reduces the time it takes for regulators to review drugs and is granted to products that treat serious or life-threatening illnesses or serve unmet medical needs. The treatment received orphan drug designation for melanoma in January. The modified poliovirus is injected into solid tumors, which is intended to activate the patient's immune response to attack the cancer cells. And finally, on this week's healthcare page, under the heading of Based in Durham, comes the article Humacyte Expands Partnership. A Durham regenerative medicine firm is expanding its partnership to commercialize its lab-grown blood vessels with a lead investor in its deal to go public by merging with a special purpose acquisition firm. Humacyte said recently that it is expanding its 2018 distribution agreement with dialysis company Fresenius Medical Care to commercialize the vessels, which are acellular and intended to allow an individual's own cells to repopulate the walls of the vessels with a growth of functioning as if they were the patient's own. The deal originally gave Fresenius the exclusive rights to commercialize the vessels in treating patients in need of hemodialysis and those with narrowed or blocked arteries. The expanded agreement extends the commercialization rights outside of the U.S. and European Union to include repairing blood vessels that have suffered traumatic damage. The agreement does not include rights for other treatments such as coronary artery bypass grafting and pediatric heart surgery. Fresenius is the leading participant in the $175 million private investment in public equity, or PIPE, financing, accompanying Humacyte's pending merger with SPAC Alpha Healthcare Acquisition Corporation, which was announced in February. The original deal with Fresenius included a $150 million equity investment. Now we'll turn the page in this week's journal, and we arrive at the retail and restaurants page. And under the heading of Hillsborough Street, the article, Finally, Project Ramps Up. a Raleigh real estate firm plans to revitalize the site of a failed seven-story mixed-use project across from the NC State University campus. CityPlat will bring retail and hospitality businesses to 2510 Hillsborough Street, the location of the previously planned Hillsborough Lofts student complex that was derailed by construction delays. Work began on the former Two Guys Pizza spot in 2015, but stalled. And developer Hillsborough Lofts, LLC, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy 2 years later. The new plan still catered to students, but will include restaurants on the sub-story level and on what will become a rooftop with an open-air concept, CityPlat principal Pat Moore says. The firm is working with Maryland-based investor Modalia Capital on the project, which will cost about $2 to $3 million. It's one of multiple projects the firm are partnering on in Raleigh. Unlike the previous proposal for the site, which is next to a Target store, they are foregoing the idea of building multiple stories. That project wasn't viable. That's when it failed and people backed out of it, Moore says of Hillsborough Loft. They didn't look at it from our vantage point. We understand that value of retail there. With all the new student housing that's been built in recent years, there's thousands of students within a 2 to 3 block radius that can walk there. That creates demand that needs to be satisfied. He said they're bullish on retail and hospitality and outdoor spaces, which allow for social distancing. We like the hospitality industry coming out of COVID, because there have been a lot of businesses that unfortunately have not been able to make it through, Moore says. Demand for going out is as good, if not greater, than it was pre-COVID because everyone has been cooped up for a year. CityPlat and Modalia Capital have several projects in the area, including 504 Hillsborough Street and 701 Glenwood Avenue, which will feature similar concepts. And under the heading of After 40 Years comes the article, Beloved Chapel Hill Restaurant Closes. A legendary Chapel Hill restaurant, labeled as the home of shrimp and grits, has closed after 40 years. Crook's Corner at 610 West Franklin Street will no longer serve its southern cuisine, according to posts on the restaurant's social media pages. The restaurant, with its pink pig statue resting above the entrance, is a landmark near the intersection of West Franklin Street and North Merritt Mill Road. With an incredibly heavy heart, I must share the news that we are closing, an Instagram post reads. The position we find ourselves in, exacerbated by the COVID-19 crisis, is no longer tenable. The restaurant thanked the community for its support throughout the years, saying, "It has been an incredible honor to both serve our community and our place, and serve as Chapel Hill's culinary ambassador to the wider world." "Extremely sad to read this news," one commenter replied. "So many wonderful nights spent on the patio. Is there still time to say goodbye?" Shannon Healy, owner of Alley 26 in Durham, took over Crook's Corner in 2019. Gene Hamer and Chef Bill Neal opened the restaurant in 1982. And finally, on the retail and restaurants page from this week's journal, under the heading of Cary and Raleigh, comes the article, Retail Center's Owner Files for Bankruptcy. The owner of two shopping areas in the Triangle is seeking Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection as it tries to recover from the pandemic's impact. Ohio-based Washington Prime Group, which has retail properties across the country, has filed voluntary positions in the United States Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of Texas after experiencing ongoing financial troubles, the company recently announced. However, the company said operations will continue as normal at its properties, including McGregor Village in Cary and North Ridge Shopping Center in Raleigh. Washington Prime has entered into a restructuring agreement led by SVP Global, a Connecticut-based firm that specializes in managing distressed debt. The restructuring could deleverage $950 million of the company's balance sheet and contemplates a $325 million equity rights offering, according to the company. The company has secured $100 million in new money debtor-in-possession financing to support operations at its retail properties, according to court documents. Well, now, as we turn the page, we reach the Executive Voice page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And this week's Executive Voice belongs to Lynn Minges, M-I-N-G-E-S. And I apologize if I'm pronouncing that name wrong. Like so many others in the Triangle, the president and CEO of the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association was excited for her first-time dine-in experience amid the pandemic. On the night of May 22nd, when restaurants were allowed to reopen with limited capacity for in-person service, Lynn Minges and her husband Brad had dinner at the Angus Barn in Raleigh. "I'll never forget that day," Minges said. "It was unfamiliar. It was a different experience than we had had before, but I was impressed with the level of embracing the new public health initiatives. They pivoted in such an incredible way. It was a great day, and now I continue to be encouraged by what restaurants and hotels across have done." Minges had spent the previous months helping the struggling restaurant industry navigate one of the most difficult times in history. The NCRLA launched the NC Restaurant Workers Relief Fund to give $500 in assistance for qualified restaurant and hotel workers. The fund received over 15,000 applications and raised about $1.5 million. Also, NCRLA worked with Governor Roy Cooper's administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, and lawmakers to help establish industry-wide operations guidelines. The organization helped bring about policies that allowed for to-go alcohol sales and other measures that allowed businesses to pivot. Also, the organization helped spearhead Count On Me NC, a public health initiative to grow awareness of safety protocols taken by businesses to fight the spread of the coronavirus. "I've been honored to represent the interests of incredibly dynamic and passionate and hardworking owners, operators, and employees who are part of the North Carolina hospitality family," Minges says. "The situation has allowed me to call on my background experience and the relationships I've made through years of service. That's helped us find our way to hopefully better days ahead." Since 2012, Minges has been with NCRLA, which represents over 20,000 restaurant and lodging businesses in the state. The industries have an economic impact of more than $23 billion for North Carolina, according to the organization. The Nonprofit Trade Association was established in 1947 to protect the interests of people who serve in those industries. "We work hard to advocate for them and provide them with information and serve as a resource for them, particularly when they interface the government at all levels," Minges said. The Bladen County native attended NC State University, where she earned a bachelor's degree in political science. She planned to attend law school before becoming interested in hospitality. Minges began her career in hospitality in 1983 in Pine Mountain, Georgia, at Callaway Resort and Gardens as a convention sales and marketing manager. She and her husband moved to North Carolina in 1993, and she joined the NC Department of Commerce, where she served in several leadership roles in the tourism division. She helped support restaurants, hotels, and attractions across the state for nearly 20 years. Minges says she enjoyed her service through the state agency, but was attracted to how the NCRLA took a different approach at helping the industries, which typically hired about 11% of the state's workforce. Pre-pandemic, the industries employed about 510,000 people. "I had always felt the hospitality and tourism industries were a growing part of the state's economy, but had never found its voice," she said. "We had strong convention bureaus and tourism promotion experts, but we had not done as good a job as we could have on harnessing our collective voice for advocacy." Since she joined NCRLA, she says the organization has had significant growth in membership, revenue, and political and advocacy fund contributions. In 2020, the organization had $1.8 million in revenue, in addition to the philanthropic arm, raising about $1.5 million. Minges is optimistic about the future, as the hospitality industry has had relief with the economy reopening and vaccinations becoming more widespread. In the future, she looks forward to taking a family vacation. Outside of work, Mindy enjoys spending time with her husband, adult daughters Caroline and Elizabeth, and granddaughters. She also plans on making more trips to her home on the coast. And now we've reached the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that cover story is entitled, Nightdale's Boom Has a Diverse Feel. For the past decade, Nightdale has exploded into one of the fastest growing towns in the state and has become one of the most diverse communities in the Triangle. The town's proximity to Raleigh and the extension of I-540 has positioned Nightdale to benefit from growth across the region. This boost in population is a massive change from when Mayor Jessica Day was growing up in the town. I'm one of the rare ones because I actually born and raised in this area, she says. I grew up in Nightdale having none of this, to seeing the growth to what we have right now. Day became mayor at the start of the year after the previous mayor, James Robertson, was appointed to the NC House of Representatives. She's the first African-American woman to fill that role. When Day was growing up in the 1980s, Nightdale was still a rural community. It used to be that Nightdale was a place that when I'd ask friends to come to my house, they'd say, I don't want to go all the way out there. You live in the country, Day says. Now those same friends that said it's so far out there are saying, oh yeah, I go to Nightdale all the time. But what differentiates Nightdale from many of Wake County's other boom towns is the bulk of the thousands of people moving in are people of color, a trend that has accelerated in recent years. Since 2010, Nightdale's population has surged from just over 11,400 to more than 18,100, according to Census Bureau data and financial filings with the town. That's a 59.2% increase, and much higher than Wake County's 20.1% jump at that time. And in a rarity for the Triangle, the population is more black than white. As of 2019, the town's population was 44% black, 39% white, and 12.5% Hispanic, according to census data. Overall, Wake County is 60% white, 21% black, and 10% Hispanic. And as companies around the country launch efforts to boost diversity and inclusion in their firms, Nightdale officials and businesses spot an opportunity to attract additional investment and new jobs to the town. Nightdale has yet to land a major office hub or corporate expansion, but officials say the town is just getting started. The town has a much more suburban-type feel now, and with the live, work, play, and we have the live down, Day says. Before, we didn't have the work and play. Now we have the retail and business here, and we hope to continue to bring more places to work here. Nightdale incorporated in 1927 and spent the next 13 years adding shops and businesses to its bustling downtown, and new residents continued filtering into the area. But it was all undone overnight. In 1940, a fire destroyed downtown, wiping out years of progress. According to the town, inadequate water access left the town with little more than a bucket brigade to fight the fire until the Raleigh Fire Department could swoop in to stop it. By then, the fire had destroyed the downtown corridor, and it was never rebuilt. Today, the area around First Street and North First Avenue features a smattering of restaurants, parks, and homes. In the decades following the fire, Nightdale continued to serve as a largely rural bedroom community to Raleigh. That began to change in the 1990s when growth in the Triangle began spilling over into areas that previously saw little to none. Nightdale's location alone positioned it to catch the growth coming off downtown Raleigh. We're surrounded by institutions of higher education, and that makes a difference, former Mayor Robertson says. Go up the street a few miles, and you have two historic black institutions, St. Augustine's University and Shaw University. Wake Tech is just 8 miles away. Anytime you see, I believe, educational opportunities in your backyard, – it's going to attract a more diverse demographic of folks that wish to come and live. Knightdale also benefited from infrastructure improvements needed to meet the growth in the Triangle, especially I-540, says Knightdale Town Manager Bill Summers. The big jumpstart to Knightdale is infrastructure improvements with I-87 and I-540, Summers says. One of the greatest days for Knightdale is when we won the transportation sweepstakes with Interstate 540. Suddenly, residents could reach Research Triangle Park in around a half an hour as a growing number of employment opportunities became well within residents' reach. And Knightdale had the benefit of having homes that were more affordable than some of the more built-out towns in West Wake. According to Zillow, the average home price in Knightdale is $263,000. That's far lower than Cary, $434,000, Apex, $427,000, Holly Springs, $391,000, and Fuquay Verena, $317,000. When Robertson moved to Knightdale in 1993, the town had fewer than 2,000 residents. Adding services and investment was key. The town has seen a number of medical and health services open up in Knightdale, including Rex Healthcare of Knightdale, which opened in 2009. When you're focused on moving to a community, you want to make sure you have access to the programs and services. And one of the top things off the list are healthcare agencies, Robertson says. We began to see that take place in Knightdale, as well as access to Knightdale. Knightdale has also seen several park projects undertaken and in the works to build community spaces and features that residents expect and want in a permanent hometown. Meanwhile, all this growth has spurred a surge in development. Builders from around the country and here in the Triangle have flooded into the growing town with plans for everything from mixed-use and apartment projects to massive industrial parks to residential developments. On the commercial side, several industrial parks have come or are planned for the area as demand for industrial space continues at a blistering pace. In 2019, developer Trinity Capital bought the Eastgate 540 Park with plans for a major multi-building expansion. That project is due to wrap up this year, 4 years ahead of a schedule due to demand. Meanwhile, Maryland developer Merritt Properties have filed plans for the Merritt Midway Business Park, a development calling for up to 5 flex and light industrial buildings totaling 271,450 square feet. As all this growth continues, Knightdale has taken a more hands-on but flexible approach to working with developers. The town works with form-based zoning code, meaning it has additional flexibility to work with developers on their plans. The result for Knightdale has been a process that sees more conversations with developers around the plans for the project and how they will fit with the town's existing communities and its vision for the future, according to Chris Hills, Knightdale's Development Services Director. On the other hand, he says the more flexible zoning allows developers to get a better return on investment as more of the land can be used and fewer hurdles may be encountered. The past few years have seen a flood of developer interest in town, though officials say they've worked to maintain the small town's feel and character amid the growth. Still, not everyone agrees. And Summers says all this growth and change has led to some attention about residents unhappy with the way things are going. Public hearings have become much more adversarial than they have in the past with scope and scale of the developments that have been proposed, he says. Like a lot of high-growth environments, you have an established population that doesn't want to see change. There's not just cultural diversity, but a diversity of viewpoints. One resident and business owner who feels the town has maintained its small-town feel is Christopher Prieto, the renowned chef and founder of Prime Barbecue in Knightdale. Born in Texas, he and his family moved to Wake Forest around the end of his time in high school. He graduated from East Carolina University and built a career as a master barbecue chef, traveled the world, and starred on television shows, among other things. A few years ago, he decided to start a restaurant and began shopping around for towns in the Triangle. Prieto says he was looking for a town with an authentic small-town feel and a vision that he could support. Many of the towns he found didn't quite hit the points he wanted until he met former Knightdale Mayor Russell Killen. He showed me around, and mayors don't do that, Prieto says. Immediately, I knew this was the town. Prieto bought a property at 403 Knightdale Station Run near Knightdale Station Park and opened last year despite the pandemic. He also moved his home to Knightdale. All five of my children live a block away from my restaurant, and it's the coolest place to live, Prieto says. I travel the world doing barbecue, and I've seen every crazy, cool, small place for barbecue. He said among the things that made Knightdale stand out was its commitment to maintaining its small-town character. They want to keep the authenticity of the town, and I love that, Prieto says. My kids get to grow up in a small town like I did. I grew up in Richmond, Texas. There were just cows. My kids get to experience that. They don't have to be in this modern society of excess. But Knightdale shares in the challenges of other Wake County towns. If you were to look in Knightdale right now, there are no houses for sale. We don't have any available houses to meet the housing stock, Summer says. This hits at one of the top selling points in town, and officials say it could impact the town's community, as some residents may run the risk of being priced out as high-paid workers continue moving into town. We see a lot of interest in our community, but the reality is we also have concerns, Summers says. Gentrification in Wake County is a serious issue. The cost of living and the ability to live and work in this county is not available to all populations. We have serious concerns about the ability to age in place right now. In the commercial space, the town has yet to land a major economic development, with the bulk of the new space being added being industrial, multifamily, or retail. The town has not seen a major office expansion, especially compared to its Western Wake counterparts such as Cary or Holly Springs. Still, officials say Knightdale is still in an earlier stage than those towns, and that the industrial growth is a big step in the right direction. Hiltz said these kinds of developments are important when attracting a big company to town. Additionally, Knightdale has put together a business park, such as the ones in Apex or Holly Springs. Still, he says Knightdale's location and infrastructure across continue to make it a good target for business expansion. When you think of Knightdale, we want you to think of how connected Knightdale is, Hills said. We're connected to RDU, RTP, downtown Raleigh. We're really as close to downtown Raleigh as Garner is. And to live in Wake Forest and go to downtown Raleigh is a haul. We want people to realize how connected we are. There are no signs that the growth will slow. The town continues to have a mix of rural and suburban areas, even as developers continue pouring into towns with new plans and projects. People are noticing Knightdale, and we're on the map as a great place to live. And so it's exciting to be here at this time and be able to work with the team to shape it for the future, Day says. We know the change is coming. And here's a little article from the Triad Business Journal. Winston-Salem Innovation District unveils expansion. With nearly all of its 2.1 million square feet currently occupied, Innovation Quarter in downtown Winston-Salem is set to embark on its second phase. On June 14th, the Innovation Quarter officials unveiled a master plan for 1 million square feet of new office, clinical and lab space, and 15 acres of urban space covering 28 acres along both sides of Research Parkway, south of the initial phase. Unlike the first phase, comprised largely of repurposed buildings of formerly R.J. Reynolds tobacco manufacturing plants, Phase 2 will be all new construction. 10 buildings in all are proposed, featuring similar mixed uses and ground-level activation found in the existing district. The new phase is centered on Fogle Commons, a linear park designed to host larger-scale activities such as musical and arts performances, academic and corporate events, and casual play or recreation. And next we turn to the final page of this week's TBJ, the Viewpoint page. And the editor's notebook, written by, of course, the editor, his article is entitled Judge Complicates Return to Office Policies. Leave it up to Texas to make things even more complicated than they are. A U.S. District Court judge in Texas ruled in favor of a Houston Methodist hospital on June 12th. Essentially approving the hospital's mandate that every worker must be vaccinated against COVID-19 if they want to work there. The decision comes days after the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued guidelines concluding companies can legally mandate COVID-19 vaccination for all employees and new hires expected to work in the office. Of course, the 177 plaintiffs in the Texas case are appealing the decision. But the train may have already left the station on this. Nationwide, according to the Centers for Disease Control, about 44% of the population is fully vaccinated, and about 53% of the population has had at least one shot of the vaccine. Worldwide, only 6.2% of the population is fully vaccinated. While these percentages are going to inch up in the next few months, very little is expected to change as far as worker sentiments go. We have a percentage of the population and the workforce who simply are not ready to get back to work. About 30% of white-collar employees working in the nation's top 10 cities are currently working from office, according to Castle Systems, a company that keeps track of access card swipes in more than 2,500 office buildings. Companies such as JPMorgan Chase and Salesforce have come out in recent days stating most of their offices will open soon and they expect their workers to come to work. If companies make it a mandate for workers to come back to work and be fully vaccinated, we may have a turnover tsunami. While for employers' perspective it makes sense to have equitable guidelines for all workers, the reluctant workforce sees it in a different way. To most of them, if things work well when they were at home, why change now when there are still lingering issues relating to COVID-19? The main argument against having a permanent work-from-home policy for everyone is sustainability. Behavioral scientists already have written papers concluding work-from-home worked for many businesses because everyone assumed it was temporary. There was a sense of vanity in the new work environment that made many workers actually work harder and longer hours to prove that they're not just eating bonbons and drawing a paycheck from the employer. A mandate to require vaccination and return to offices poses another scenario that likely will pay out when, not if, we have a downturn in our economy. If, in fact, workers made the switch to other companies that offered more flexibility, what will happen when it comes time for these companies to lay off people? Will it be easier to let go workers who work from home? Will the flexibility be a silent hindrance to progress in the end? The district judge in Texas ruling said it succinctly. Plaintiffs were within their right to refuse the vaccine, but that they would have to find employment elsewhere and have no claim for wrongful termination. Companies are staring at some major decisions that are not only relate to their workforces, but also its intangible assets, such as office and other real estate expenses. But perhaps their biggest worry should be what always has been the biggest driver of profits, expansion, and culture, workers. If talent leaves the door because of the vaccine-related guidelines, the problems will linger for a while. And for workers, if vaccine guidelines determine their choice of employer, they may be making a decision for the wrong reason. The Texas judgment is only getting things started. This week's guest column is written by John Hood, who's chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh, and his article is entitled "Stop Kicking the Social Security Can." All of the politicians in Washington almost never talk about the issue anymore. Our entitlement programs are on a collision course with fiscal reality. Let's zero in on Social Security. Its trust fund, which consists entirely of debt the federal government has issued to itself, will be exhausted in a decade or so. As a practical matter, this isn't as big a deal as it sounds. Social Security is already running a cash deficit, more payments going out than payroll taxes coming in. To cover the difference, the federal government draws from its trust fund of federal bonds. In other words, it draws from its general revenues to pay Social Security benefits. If the trust fund didn't exist, Washington would draw from its general revenues to pay Social Security benefits. Nevertheless, as a legal matter, the coming in exhaustion of the trust fund will trigger a crisis. Let's say it happens in 2032. At that point, federal law will require that Social Security benefits be lowered across the board until they can be financed entirely by payroll taxes. That would be an immediate 21% cut. Now, if you've been thinking about Social Security's unfunded liabilities at all, you probably have a preferred solution. I happen to think that the best solution at this point is to apply a means test to benefits, making the program more explicitly a redistributive safety net rather than pretending it can be the centerpiece of household savings for retirement. But whatever we do, we need to get on with it. The longer we wait, the costlier the intervention will be. That's the main conclusion of a new National Bureau of Economic Research paper. The authors, John Chauvin and John Watson, both of Stanford University, and Sita Nataraj Slavov of the American Enterprise Institute, didn't just look at estimates of the effects of various reforms on Social Security's structural deficit. They also examined the costs of political dithering about reform. Knowing in advance which reform will be implemented allows for better planning and therefore has value, they wrote. The government could resolve that indecision by deciding today what steps it will take to close Social Security's shortfall. I know why Democrats and Republicans alike don't want to talk about this. Each of the practical options for bringing Social Security costs in line with revenues will make a large block of voters angry. 20 years ago, when there was some momentum in Washington to construct a bipartisan solution, politicians could have made virtually all of the benefit changes prospective, affecting only future retirees, and given people lots of time to accumulate savings in personal accounts. It is, however, too late now to engineer a soft landing. It was a missed opportunity, a failure of political leadership and imagination, also a costly one. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. So for comments, call us, 919-832-5138.